Tonight on the Daily Debrief, a verdict for three Chicago cops accused of covering up a deadly police shooting. And the defense tactic becomes clear as an Ohio woman admits killing her military husband. Also, they're still fighting over whether this is blood on the table of a California family found dead and buried in the Mojave Desert. Plus, closing arguments in a case where a New Jersey son says he watched his dad stab his mother to death. This is the Daily Debrief for Thursday, January 17th. Good evening, folks. Welcome to the Daily Debrief. I'm Aaron Keller, along with Donald Papsy and Ashley Wilcott. Not guilty. That is the verdict for all three defendants in the case of an alleged cop cover-up of a deadly Chicago police shooting. The charges stem from what happened in dash cam video showing Laquan McDonald getting shot and killed by Jason Van Dyke, a police officer. These three officers you're looking at right now faced separate charges related to the shooting. Prosecutors accused them of conspiracy, official misconduct, and obstruction of justice. In essence, they're accused of concealing the true facts of the shooting. David March was the lead detective. Joseph Walsh was the partner of the officer who pulled the trigger. There's a look at that video that we were talking about a split second ago. It shows Officer Jason Van Dyke shooting and killing knife-wielding teenager Laquan McDonald. Originally, police said the shooting was justified. A year later, they released this full recording. And because of that, prosecutors charged Van Dyke, and a jury convicted him of second-degree murder last year. This was a bench trial. The judge said the state did not prove its case against those three other officers beyond a reasonable doubt. Here is the verdict.
This court has found that the state did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there was an agreement between any of these defendants or others or any act in furtherance of the agreement. As such, the court finds there was no conspiracy and all the emails are therefore irrelevant. Conclusion. The crux of this case rises and falls on whether the information that the officers, including March, put in their reports or told the March was false, and if so, was it done to prevent Van Dyke from further investigation or prosecution? For the reasons stated above, this court finds that the state has failed to meet its burden on all charges. Therefore, there is a finding of not guilty as to every count and each defendant of conspiracy, official misconduct, and obstruction of justice.
The convicted trigger man in this case is due back in court tomorrow to be sentenced. Jason Van Dyke faces a possible sentence of 4 to 20 years on his second-degree murder conviction, but he could also be sentenced to just probation on the other counts. On that count, rather, that same count. He also faces a sentence of 6 to 30 years on his aggravated battery convictions. The defense is seeking the absolute minimum under Illinois law. The sentences must not run back-to-back because they all involve the same event. Our guests tonight, as I said off the top of the broadcast, are criminal defense attorney Donald Papsy and juvenile court judge Ashley Wilcott. I know you were both here when that verdict came down, so Donald, your reaction.
Very surprised. After the Van Dyke trial, you just expect that they're going to come down and say that these people were guilty. But I guess after the judge was very thorough. It was a genius move by electing for a judge to try this case, I think, instead of to a jury, because you have the judge very methodically just going through what the law is, what she sees as the evidence, and then making her determination. So I guess in that sense, maybe not as much as a surprise, but a surprise nonetheless.
Ashley, your thoughts?
No, I wasn't surprised here. And for the reason that I did think there were inconsistencies and a lot of different good arguments made by the defense, I really appreciated how thorough she was. And she looked at all the different pieces of evidence and made findings based on each piece of evidence. I think she did a phenomenal job in coming up with this verdict.
You know, I was wondering if this would be a case where we would see a split verdict, where the judge would turn around and say, okay, well, this piece of evidence might indicate one finding as to this defendant on this count and a different finding as to a different defendant on a different count. I was a little surprised to see it just go across the board with not guilty.
You know, I have to say, Aaron, I thought it would be possibly the obstruction. Like, I did think that, I mean, unbecoming to an officer, I thought that piece might be a find guilty, but boy, was she thorough.
Donald, it seemed to me that the judge was correct when she said, okay, there wasn't enough evidence of a conspiracy. There wasn't smoking gun. You know, okay, maybe it doesn't look good, but that doesn't necessarily make it illegal. That in order for there to be a conspiracy, there has to be more overt acts than what we actually saw here.
I mean, everything, when you look at it, when everything's pretty much the same, their statements are the same, that everything's very consistent, almost maybe a little bit too consistent. You know that they were there. You have testimony from an officer saying that they all met, watched the video, and then gave sort of testimony that was not exactly like what you saw in the video, gave statements, you know, afterwards, especially the head investigating officer. It's, you know, when you see those things, it does make you a little uneasy when you see police officers sort of walk on that, because you just can't prove anything, because you start to feel like, well, when really can you? Unless you're there and you have hard proofs, people like coming forward saying, yeah, I was part of the conspiracy. It's a pretty tough burden to prove.
Well, look, I mean, we've got the sentencing tomorrow for Jason Van Dyke over the Laquan McDonald shooting. And it's interesting that this judge in this case kept pushing back the reading of the verdict. Maybe she was leaning this way, and that's why she pushed it back, because we've got the sentencing tomorrow that, of course, we will be watching. We'll check in with you both at the end of the broadcast. Day two of testimony now in the case of a woman who admitted to killing her military husband. Claudia Herrig is charged with aggravated murder with a firearm over the death of Ohio Air Force Reserve Major Carl Herrig. Claudia is accused of draining Carl's bank accounts, seizing his money, his money to her relatives in Brazil, and practicing at a shooting range before pulling the trigger and killing him. Authorities say she then, of course, fled to Brazil to join her relatives. Brazil's constitution prevented her extradition, so it took threats by the U.S. Congress to stop processing Brazilian visas to get the government of Brazil to rescind Claudia's citizenship. That is how she wound up back in America for trial. The defense is explaining her behavior as part of the process of splitting up. They say this marriage was headed for divorce. This morning, the detective who tracked the defendant from the scene to New York to Brazil faced this cross-examination. It did include charges of lying and questions about a suicide attempt.
In your career as a police officer, you've lied in a sworn affidavit, haven't you?
No.
Objection. You haven't?
Answer the question.
Not when you were an officer in Brookfield?
There was a...
Answer the question, yes or no, detective. I just want to know if you lied in an affidavit when you were an officer in Brookfield. I don't need
an answer. Do you want the circumstances?
No, sir. I want to know yes or no.
I was... Yes. No, I didn't lie. I did not lie in that affidavit.
Okay. All right, well, let's talk. I'll just move on. We learned that on February 6th, 2007, that Claudia had attempted suicide by taking some pills. Isn't that true?
I don't remember how that information came to us, but yes, I recall that.
Well, you pulled the police report for that incident, didn't you?
Yes.
You learned that Carl was unconcerned about the suicide
attempt.
I'm going
to object to that. He's asking me. I don't
know. All right, I'll move on. In that phone call, did Carl say that that they were having marital problems?
I'm going to object to that. It's hearsay. He doesn't have the document in front of him.
He listened to it, Your Honor.
Remember
he takes
what the 911 was.
Okay.
What's the hearsay exception that this is coming under?
It's a 911 call.
Well, then subpoena it and play it.
I don't need to if it's... I won't argue with you, Chris. I certainly don't want to go down that road. Judge, may I approach?
Boy, that cross-examination was as rocky as they say the marriage was. Look, the defense says that the relationship between this husband and wife led to a shooting in a fit of rage. In other words, the defense theory is voluntary manslaughter under Ohio law. That carries a 3 to 10 year sentence. The state says, no, this was premeditated murder and should result in a possible life sentence. Now let's listen to more of the cross-examination about the defendant's internet searches.
The night before the shooting, she had searched the web for suicide, right?
I believe that was one of the web searches, yes.
Suicide by gun?
I don't recall the exact... If you have the analysis, I'd be glad to look at it. But I don't remember the particular topic. But yes, there was something...
Along
those lines, yes.
Okay. Recoil, do you remember that one in particular?
I do not.
Okay. And you didn't find anything that said murder by gun, correct?
No, I did not.
Right. Did you find any internet searches that said how to get away with murder?
No.
How to escape?
No.
How to plan a murder?
No.
How to dispose of a body?
No.
Okay.
The state is pushing hard on its theory that this was a crime of premeditation. Yesterday, a gun store employee said the defendant came in with questions about guns and eventually made a purchase.
She came in carrying a book, the book that most guys are using for concealed carry classes, and she had things marked in her book. She had several questions. I don't remember all the questions specifically, but I tried to explain and answer her questions.
Do you recall what some of the questions were? I mean, you may not remember every one, but do you remember in general or what they were about?
I know she asked about semi-automatic versus revolvers, and she had some questions about ammunition.
Okay. And at the time, did she indicate she was interested in purchasing a firearm?
Yes.
Initially, what type of firearm did she indicate or express an interest in, or did she even point to one?
I remember her looking at a Smith & Wesson Model 29, which is a 44 Magnum. I asked her what she wanted to do with it, and she didn't. She said she didn't want a gun to carry, but she wanted one for protection. And I explained to her that a 44 Magnum isn't good for beginners because of recoil and muzzle blast. It's not something easy to start out with.
And what did you tell her about the .357?
That she could shoot .38 special ammunition in it for practice, and the recoil was pretty low on that, and it was less expensive.
Okay.
Or she could use the .357 Magnum for defense, which had a lot more muzzle blast and recoil, but it was more effective.
Back to the panel on this one. Donald, let me ask you, did she buy the gun for protection, or did she buy it because she was premeditating murder?
I mean, you heard all the questions that she was asking there.
You could argue both ways, though. Because they're saying, look, this is a relationship that was falling apart. There's allegations that it was getting abusive, at least according to the defense. And they're trying to say that's what this was. And then that led to this crime of passion. Oh, by the way, the penalty is very minor compared to what the state's going for.
Right. And the whole, she was going to try to commit suicide, but then she turned, to him and decided to shoot him instead. I mean, none of that really goes along with the kinds of questions that you ask when you're buying a gun like the ones that she was asking.
Ashley, I want to ask you a good legal tactic here, good cross-examination on the tail end of that police officer, really going for every possible question about her internet search. That's textbook cross-examination.
Yeah,
they just get pounding the point.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what you do. And that is an effective cross-examination because you want to get the jury to hear that and you want to hear them answer those closed questions where they have to say yes or no. Oh, we need you to answer yes or no. We need you to answer yes or no. That is textbook.
Okay, look. Seems to me that this is going to come down to the trajectory of the shots here. Because if she's trying to say this was a crime of passion, something like that, why the shots to the back? Why the shots to the head? That sounds a lot more sinister, at least in my opinion, and maybe I'm wrong, than your average crime of passion. Donald, what do you think?
You can make an argument that if you really got to a point where you were so angry at somebody that you would shoot them, that you would keep shooting them because you maintain that level of anger. So maybe that's what you go with in that scenario.
And Ashley, she's going to take the stand. That was promised in the opening statement. She's going to have to, based on the way they're trying to push this case forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a risk in that, but that's going to be some of the best evidence for the defense if she can hold up and her story is consistent with their argument on defense.
And some of her previous statements coming back on the plane from Brazil and whatnot, the prosecutors just say, no, she's spinning her wheels, telling different stories. I'm waiting to hear this. I'm curious how this is going to go.
Absolutely.
I think you both agree.
Yes. Okay. No. Yep.
Let's move on to the McStay family murders in California, where defendant Charles Merritt faces a possible death sentence if convicted in the killings of business associate Joseph McStay, McStay's wife, and the couple's two sons. At first, the authorities wondered if the McStay family had gone to Mexico to avoid business debts, but suspicions eventually focused on the defendant. Prosecutors believe Merritt killed the family, dumped their car near the border, and dumped their bodies in two graves in the desert. Merritt's DNA is on the steering wheel and gear shift of the McStay family vehicle, but the defense says that's because Merritt and McStay shook hands at a restaurant before the disappearance. Testimony today centered back on those suspicious red spots found on the family's table. Police who combed the missing family's home, looking for clues in the early days of this case, back when it was a disappearance, missed those spots at first. Enlarged photos made the spots more clear.
When I saw it, I was horrified.
Why?
Because I thought it was something I missed. And horrified me to think that I would miss that.
You don't recall seeing that day?
I know I didn't see that day.
Okay. Based on your experience of processing crime scenes, did you have a belief of what it could be?
Objection. Yes. Calls for speculation.
Overruled.
And what was that?
I thought it could be blood. I'm not a blood spatter examiner. That takes tons more training than I have. But I have had classes in blood spatter. And to me, it looked like...
I'm going to object to the foundation. If she's not an expert, the best
thing.
Have you seen blood spatter previously, though, in investigations?
Yes.
Have you documented it?
Yes.
Have you tested it?
Yes.
You have experience looking at items that are potentially blood spatter, correct?
Yes.
And based on that experience and what training you do have, why were you concerned that you missed this?
Objection as to relevance and foundation.
Well, I was very concerned because if it was blood, I felt like it was something that could have been, at the very least, something... We're doing an investigation, and it would have been something that would have been very good to know then.
More questions than answers. Still ahead tonight, that case of the New Jersey dad accused of stabbing his estranged wife in front of their son. Closing arguments as the jury takes the case. Our recap after the break. Welcome back to The Debrief, everyone. A jury is going to come back tomorrow to deliberate the case of a New Jersey man accused of murdering his wife while their 12-year-old son watched. Defendant Jeremiah Monell faces first-degree murder and other charges over the death of Tara O'Shea Watson. Prosecutors say he stabbed her 48 times. Monell's son testified that he witnessed some of the stabbing. The testimony of the son was the cornerstone of the prosecution case. Here are some of the closing arguments.
The 89 stab wounds described by Dr. Matone and sharp force injury wounds described by her, defense wants you to draw an inference that that's evidence of passion. I would suggest to you it's evidence of a person's depravity, of their state of mind, of a vile and horrible and inhuman action. That it's evidence of torture, that it's evidence of an aggravated assault. That's what it's evidence of. And the most compelling evidence that shows that is exactly what happened about this time 1 week ago. You can bring that testimony to the front of your minds now. And young Jeremiah sat up there and told you what happened that night.
Defense attacked inconsistencies with the son's testimony. The possibility that the palm print on one of the suspected murder weapons is not the defendant's, and to the DNA question. That question now, though, is whether the strategy will work.
Apply your common sense to the equation, folks. Go back to that evidence. Two knives. One knife only has Tara Monell's DNA. The other knife, Tara Monell is the major contributor. Jeremiah Monell perhaps is a minor contributor. So is every other African American on the planet, 50% of Caucasians. What happened? J. young Jeremiah did not see this whole event happen. He didn't see all that occurred. So what is it that he didn't see that he was unable to tell you? Was there a fight? Did Jeremiah Monell actually act in self-defense? I don't know. Those questions are left open for you to answer. When you go back there and you deliberate, you go over this evidence that you've been presented with, consider it carefully, and you fulfill your duty, you're confident that you'll come back with a verdict of not guilty. Thank you.
Attorney Donald Papsy, Judge Ashley Wilcott back with us tonight. Not exactly an awe-inspiring speech, not exactly a firm way to end it, you know, kind of looking at the floor and saying, I'm confident you'll find someone not guilty, and walking back to the chair in the process of saying it. One has to wonder what looks that attorney is getting back from the jurors, though, because remember, those jurors sat through lengthy testimony from the defendant's own son pointing and saying, yeah, my dad did it. I watched it go down. He talked to me afterwards and told me I wasn't supposed to see it. Are jurors just basically not even looking back at him, paying attention? That's what I'm wondering.
There are people with those styles, that sort of Columbo, shucks, you know, I don't know, I see this, but you should really look at that. And they have that style, and they suck people in because it's very believable, and it comes across very well and very down to earth. But I don't think that's what you're seeing here. I just think you're seeing someone that just doesn't have a lot of charisma, and that defendant needs a little more charisma, I think.
Ashley, what do you think? Take it away. Take the analysis away.
Okay, so I do think the jury is going to notice that he didn't have charisma. It fell flat, so I didn't hear him arguing any of the reasonable doubt that might exist based on the defendant's position. And so for me, it really fell flat. He brought in some personal example of going to the Lion King and speeding. He thought he forgot his tickets. Is that appropriate in a murder trial? Is that going to speak to a jury? I personally don't think it will.
Look, the defense did have a couple of points here. You know, one is that the defendant's son said, somebody was smoking cigarettes, and it was my dad, but then they found the dad's DNA on some cigarettes and some unknown DNA on some of the other cigarettes. And a few people were wondering, hey, look, are we going to get some kind of an argument out of the defense that the son is conflating some other domestic incidents together with this actual incident? Point to the unknown DNA and say there's your reasonable doubt. Point to the inconsistencies with the palm print evidence, the fear that it's not a very exact science, and say, okay, and on top of that, we don't have the defendant's DNA clearly on the knives. Ashley, would that have been more effective?
I think it would have been more effective because don't forget the 12-year-old testified he had a blanket over his head a lot of the time. So that, with all those other arguments, could equal reasonable doubt.
The table blocking the view as well. Look, bottom line, the jury's got this case. The jury's coming back tomorrow. Donald, Ashley, appreciate your insights on the debrief tonight.
Thank you.
That's going to wrap things up. Live trial coverage beginning back at 9 o'clock Eastern on the Law and Crime Network. I'll see you on the debrief from 4 to 4:30. For those of you watching on the Law and Crime Network, I'll be back in a few moments with more live trial coverage. For those of you watching elsewhere, have a good night.